The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is kind of an experiment.
This is a new show. We've never done this before. Новое шоу. Мы раньше этого никогда не делали с переводом.
Я очень неопытный в данном случае.
Да, я думала, что мы просто разговаривать будем без этих.
When the Belarusian writer Svetlana Alexeyevich won the Nobel Prize in Literature last year, it surprised people in a couple of ways. In this country, even among big readers, the name Alexeyevich was not particularly familiar. But it was more unusual that she was a nonfiction writer, which is a real rarity with the Nobel. Alexeyevich's books are all put together from interviews with regular people about life during and after the existence of the Soviet Union. She's been described as a journalist, but as she sees it, that's not quite it, and she really bridles at the term.
Когда хотят сказать, что это журналистика, нет, это не журналистика.
It's not journalism. It's a different view on things. It's the view of literature. It's a wider view. Journalism deals with banalities. It picks up only the surface layer. I am also a witness of this time, and I approach another witness, and we try to talk. I try to make it so that people speak, as Dostoevsky said, in what he called a more human language, a deeper language.
И эти люди, они вокруг меня, это мои соседи, это мои друзья, это люди, которых я вижу на улице.
And these people are the people around me, these are my neighbors, my friends, these are people I see on the streets. I didn't need to seek them out. Enter any house, and so much suffering will be poured out to you that you'll hardly be able to walk out of the house.
Потому что документ — это живое существо, оно находится в движении.
Also, this document is a living creature, and it changes. In 2000, for example, after Perestroika, the women in my book War Has Not a Woman's Face, they said, we want to meet with you again, because back then, we didn't tell you everything. We were afraid, or we didn't understand.
Now, there's a wealth of fascinating interviews in this book, and there's also a refusal to differentiate between the oppressed and the oppressor. For example, you're talking to an architect named Anna, who's about 59 or 60 years old. And at one point, after she's talked to you for many pages about her life and her suffering, she says that people now are all trying to put on the striped uniform of the victim, of the prisoner. But somehow now everyone's the victim and Stalin is alone to blame. But think about it. It's simple arithmetic. Millions of inmates had to be surveilled, arrested, interrogated, transported, and shot for minor transgressions. Someone had to do all of this. So to what extent is everybody from the Soviet past an accomplice?
Дело в том, что я могу сказать, что в 90-е годы мы очень судили.
The truth is, in the 90s, we really judged our parents. And I remember how I fought with my father when I went to Afghanistan and saw what the Soviet army was doing there. I came home and I said to my father, who was very much a communist until the end of his life, Papa, we are murderers. And he began to cry. He didn't argue with me. That doesn't mean I don't have an obligation to give a voice to a person like my father, to cry out his life. In my work, everyone cries out their own truth. I never allow myself to say, this one's just a stereotypical Soviet, this one's part of the herd, as they sometimes say. Because first of all, that's not the truth. That's arrogance. From the point of view of art, both Stalin and the victim are equally interesting. We must understand, what is this? Who are they? Why? But that doesn't mean that the executioners and the victims are equal. To understand good and evil, portraits of their vessels must be studied and meticulously painted.
Для меня, например, было очень радостно слышать, когда
I was very glad when at a meeting in France, one young man stood up and said, I don't understand. What is the problem with your people? You got freedom and you refused freedom. What kind of people are you? But I read your book and it became absolutely clear to me where Putin came from, why you had refused freedom.
Well, maybe you should answer that question a little bit more broadly and deeply about what comes out of this. The book is filled with stories of people whose hopes were raised, who were confused by and yet thrilled by the late 80s and 90s, and then fell into immense disappointment, confusion, and poverty.
Да, почему мы идем все время по кругу истории и все время, как говорят...
I think I try to answer this throughout the whole book. Why do we walk through this circular history? Why do we, as we say in Russian, step on the same rake again and again? In the 90s, I remember, my generation really believed that tomorrow would bring freedom. We ran through the squares, we cried out, freedom, freedom, and then we went our different ways, into our houses. And then we acted as if Yeltsin would bring freedom, Putin would bring freedom, someone would bring it.
Does this pattern of repeating history to some degree, the inability to for the Russian people and people in surrounding countries to thrust themselves out of this terrible cycle of history, is this related to what people talk about when they talk about русские особенности? Is there something about Russia, Russian history, Russian geography, character somehow that is a kind of destiny?
Мне кажется, это вечная русская мечтательность, вечная русская надежда на чудо.
It seems to me that it's the eternal Russian dreaminess, the eternal Russian hope for a miracle, that we can go immediately from feudalism to a developed socialism. That kind of socialism could maybe happen someday. There's nothing wrong with that idea. But you can't do that right after feudalism. In 1917, when World War I had just ended, Russia was one of those backward countries. Russia had been bled dry. It wasn't the place to build socialism. And then the provocative Leninist slogans that brought out human nature, loot the looters, right? Or with an iron hand we shall drive humanity to happiness. That kind of thing from the first years of the revolution. So I think that what happens is what always happens. Russia always needs an idea, a purpose to be obsessed with.
Now you live in the era of Putin. How do you understand Putin? What does Putin understand about Russia that Gorbachev and Yeltsin did not?
Я помню, как после 90-го года вот все мы, демократы...
I remember how after the 90s all of us Democrats said, why are the people silent? We talk and talk, and the people are silent. And suddenly Putin arrives, and after a while he takes off all his masks, his playing at democracy, and speaks. He says, we need a great Russia. They are annihilating us. They are insulting us. They don't deal directly with us. And suddenly the people began to speak. And when they began to speak, it became clear. It's absolutely clear now. Gorbachev and a few of his companions created the revolution of the 90s, and the people weren't ready for it. When I was writing Secondhand Time, I traveled all over Russia. I heard the hatred, the grievances of this robbed, deceived people. There's no reason to demonize the figure of Putin like everybody does, thinking of him as the problem of problems. In truth, we're talking about our collective Putin. He has made himself the focal point of the desires of millions of people. Putin is only a metaphor for that longing. He didn't come up with it on his own. What he's doing today is really what the people want. And the Kremlin has been able to redirect all of this upheaval and dissatisfaction to find an enemy outside our borders.
I have to tell you, when I watch Russian television, the number one enemy is the United States of America.
Да, чучело Обаму жгут иногда на вне.
Yeah, in some cities they burn Obama in effigy. And not very long ago, in Yeltsin's time, America was considered our best friend. Putin appears about once a year in front of some youth organization to give a kind of program speech, and the topic is always the same, that Russia is great, but America is insulting us, Europe is insulting us. It's always an outcry that they're considered politically little punks. No one takes them seriously. It's serious, even dangerous, when a national leader like Putin says that whoever doesn't understand our politics is a national traitor. That makes me a national traitor, and others. You understand, it's the lexicon of Stalinist times.
So on the one hand, your books are published, you travel freely throughout the world, and on the other hand, you are a predatel, a betrayer.
Да, и если раньше, вот когда я писала вот книгу yes. раньше... Вот,
when I was writing 3 years ago, before Putin took off all his masks, people were ready to speak. Now they're cautious. There are three forbidden themes. Putin, the church. And it's impossible to speak about the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War. So, for example, when I won the Nobel Prize, I was hounded. It turns out I'm a Russian traitor, a Russophobe. I hate the Russian people. That is Putin, right? It was endless. Because of the Nobel Prize and my Nobel address, they rushed to talk about their opinions of me. What I always wanted when I wrote was for my books to start a discussion. For a long time, we've needed to start a discussion. Who are we? Where are we from?
Svetlana Alexandrovna, a final question, and it's the question you seem to pose to all of your interview subjects in this book. And on the one hand, it sounds corny, on the other hand, profound, which is to say, what does freedom mean to you? This is the question you ask everybody, and it arouses incredible divergent answers. What does it mean to you?
Но я могу сказать, что у меня Есть вот это счастливая возможность.
Happily, I can say that I can live freely. But unfortunately, many of us don't have that freedom. I can say what I want, I can write and do whatever I consider necessary. I consider myself to be a free person. And now I'm meeting with people and gathering material for two books. The first is about love, and the second is about age, about disappearing, about the 20, 30 years that progress has given us, about life without a governing idea. How does that work for us? What is it? I mean, without the kind of big idea that is always foremost in our culture, like communism or fascism.
Сначала, значит, строили великое государство.
In the beginning, they built a great state. There was no individual person. There was a kind of collective body of people. Then they built communism. There was no person, no differentiated body. And the person, where is the person? What is a person? Does he want to be happy? Does he want to die? Is all we have developed over all these years a culture of death, a culture of suffering? I can only say that my father, as I said, was a communist and believed until the end. But a lot happened to him. Alzheimer's, all that, his memory totally left him. In the beginning, he talked only about the war, about the Battle of Stalingrad, and about how beautiful my mother was. And when everything, when all of that left him, the last thing he talked about was how beautiful my mother was. I thought, only this terrible disease has freed him to speak about human things.
Svetlana Alexeyevich, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Talia Levin at The New Yorker translated her answers into English for us, and we heard the voice of WNYC's Emily Botine.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.